darkest day, in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power. Green Lantern's light.
Welcome to episode 9 of Green Lantern's Light, where we cover the saga of Hal Jordan, John Stewart, and Guy Gardner, the Green Lanterns of Earth. I am one third of your hosting trifecta, J. David Weider.
I am another third, Michael Bradley.
And I'm a full half, Jeffrey Taylor.
And this episode, we've actually got some really interesting books to look at. We're looking at Green Lantern issues 193 to 195, which also tie into Crisis on Infinite Earths. We've got a lot of stuff to cover this time around.
Yeah, but I mean, it's only a crisis. They happen all the time.
Well, they didn't when this happened.
No, I know.
Well, they were smaller, because you had Crisis on Earth 2. And...
Right. Well, that was how they collected the they weren't necessarily crises? Anyway, on this kind of a level, but they were kind of self-contained stories that involved the multiple Earths, usually crossing them over in one way or another, and then they were collected in the Crisis on Multiple Earths trades.
Which I have one of. I think I have volume 2. But who's starting us off this week?
I am.
Episode. Well, why don't we jump into the books since I'm awkwardly fumbling through a preamble?
It's all good.
It's more fun to sit here and watch you stumble over your words and be awkward with the awkward pauses.
Yes, and we do still have one more book to cover before we get into Crisis, and that is Green Lantern number 193, which has a cover date of October 1985, released July 8th for 75 cents. The title is Dead Ringer. The credits for this are on the first page. They are Steve Englehart, author, Joe Staton, penciler, Bruce Patterson, inker, L. Lois Buhalis, letterer, Anthony Tallon, colorist, and Andy Helfer, editor. I really like Andy Helfer, by the way. Anyway, picking up where the last issue left off to get into the story, John Stewart, Cat Matui, and fellow Green Lantern Dalor. That I'm saying his name right, am I? I don't know.
That works Dalor. Enough.
Yeah.
Okay. We're investigating the planet Zamoron, or is it planet Zamor and they are Zamorons? I can't remember.
It's Zamoron.
Okay, excellent. Well, that makes it easy. It's the home of Star Sapphire, where Carol Ferris, as Star Sapphire, just appeared out of nowhere, and she plays the organ there, which is about to rob all the Green Lanterns of their memories. The next thing they know, they're out in space, and it seems that Cat Matui set her ring to record all of the events and remind them of it once they were 1,000 Kosius, or 767.5 miles, from the planet. I'm guessing on Korugar, that's how they measure distances. Dalor had done the same thing, but had set it just a little bit farther, so Katna simply kicked in first. John marvels at this discovery and hopes that he learns how to do something like that with his ring someday, but Katna explains that it's simply a trick of will and that the ring just does the rest. They charge their rings with Dalor's battery before he heads off. John wants to return to the planet and take on Star Sapphire again, but neither Dalor nor Katna want to bother because they no longer need to. She and John share a loving embrace, and then they head back to Earth. On the way, she recounts her tragic lost love with a man from her home planet Korrigar named Imi Khan. Years ago, she was torn between her love for him and her duty as a Green Lantern. Hal Jordan showed up, even though John still doesn't know his name, by the way, and she ended up saving both him and Imi Khan from a giant amoeba, but her focus was on saving Hal first. Hal had pointed out that her loyalty to the Corps outweighed her feelings for this man, even though she discovered that he had created the monster that she was saving them from, and she knew that he was still right, and she rejected Imi Khan in order to go about her duty. Back in the present, on Earth, Hal returns home and is eating a can of pork and beans, unheated, just out of the can, when the phone rings. It's Tom Kalmaku, a.k.a. Pie Face. He has something important to say, but since he was so angry that he gave Hal the cold shoulder when Hal didn't consult him first before giving up his Green Lantern ring, Hal gives him a taste of his own medicine and hangs up on him. Hal once again questions if giving up the ring was the right choice and wonders if he could get it back, especially since Carol is gone now and he would need it to get her back. But he realizes that she's probably gone forever, and now that Jon Stewart is Green Lantern, it's not fair to take it away from him. Almost back to Earth, Jon and Katma pass Jupiter and near the asteroid belt between Jupiter and Mars, and Jon wonders to her about the limits of the ring and wishes there was a way for him or the Guardians to wipe Earth clean of prejudice, especially since he's a black man who has had to deal with prejudice his entire life. Katma responds that it would be no different than the Zamorons when they do their mind wipe thing for evil purposes, even though his intention is ultimately meant for good. It's still not that different. They play around in the asteroids a bit and chase each other, playing grab ass, until Jon is attacked by someone who looks sort of like Batman, but with other traits that look like Flash and Wonder Woman. Jon throws him off, and neither he nor Katma Tui recognize him. And it turns out that he's Replicon, another of the old Green Lantern's enemies. Hal Jordan's, that is. But again, Jon doesn't know his name. They fight some more until he changes shape into the form of Hal Jordan, Green Lantern. He knocks Jon down and takes the ring from him. And he uses that to knock out Katma Tui as well and takes her ring. They wake up later in a cage. And Replicon goes off about how the asteroid belt was once a planet with an atmosphere, but now it's fallen apart. And since Replicon is basically sentient gas that can take form, his children can't form themselves without an atmosphere because they are gas as well. A while back, he tried to steal Earth's ozone layer for just that purpose, but Hal Jordan stopped him. Jon Stewart convinces Replicon to give him back his ring while he holds on to Katma as a hostage and says that he'll go to Earth and come back with its atmosphere, which could kill the planet. Jon secretly intends to just go away for 24 hours while the other ring drains of power, charge his own, and come back and save her. But Katma says that's not okay. Green Lanterns don't lie. It's part of their honor code. Jon gets his ring back anyway and traps Replicon in construct armor that his gases can't escape, and he knocks him down. But Jon has an idea that might just help. He contacts the Guardians on Oa and asks permission to use the ring to recreate the planet out of the asteroids. They agree and wish to speak to Katma alone, at which point they tell her that they approve of her work with Jon as well as their romantic relationship, which they've been keeping an eye on. So Jon and Katma Tui pull the asteroids together and bring a little atmosphere from both Mars and Jupiter, as well as creating plants. Replicon's children are able to form themselves and live happily ever after, and Jon and Katma fly back to Earth. After that, there are two epilogues. The first one, the Guardians notice that the central battery is becoming unstable and there are new anomalies that could have the power to destroy entire worlds. And this all actually ties into the current crisis on Infinite Earths. The second epilogue is a very much awake Guy Gardner checking himself out of the hospital, having woken up from his coma. And he has a long overdue appointment with a ring.
Yay, Guy Gardner.
So, Michael, why don't you go first?
I dig the cover. It's a bit of a swerve from what we get inside, but in a good way. My issue with the issue, we
do have the point where Replicon turns into the form of Hal Jordan.
Yeah, that's what I say. It's a bit of a swerve, but it's in a good way. Yeah.
Okay.
My problem with the issue comes when we start the story, because we get to page 2 and that's it. I mean, that's the end of this big epic storyline that's been building for like a year and a half, or at the very least since Englehart came on board. I mean, what the heck? There's no closure, there's no climax, it just kind of stops. You know, last issue we have this epic, albeit abrupt moment where, you know, it had been revealed that Carol is Star Sapphire, and then she's transported back to Zamaron and is about to face off with the Green Lanterns, and then we start this issue and they simply poof away. Making me wonder...
It does seem weird to have that even as a cliffhanger and then come in with that splash page to say, yes, here's the story that's continuing, only no.
Yeah, I mean, and what was the point of anything that John and Katma have done for the last 3 issues? I mean, why send them to Zamaron when they didn't actually do anything there?
I'm with you on that, especially since it just seems strange that they needed to go to this planet, and then when they got there, they accomplished nothing and then said, well, we don't need to go back.
Yeah. And even worse, there's really no justice. I mean, Carol, as the Predator, ran roughshod over L.A. and wiped the memories of a half dozen characters and, let's not forget, violently murdered Jason Block, and there's absolutely no repercussions from that. The story just ends, and we're on to Crisis. Well, we're on to this stupid Replicon story, and then we're on to Crisis. So it's just a big letdown. Page 3, Dalor is using the original Alan Scott oath, which I thought was kind of neat. Page 4, here they spend... This is kind of what Jeffrey was just talking about. Here they spend 3/4 of a page explaining why they can't go back. And I'm like, no, you go back and take care of the villains. I don't care if they haven't committed any crimes that you know of. They're clearly up to something. I mean, it's right there in the oath. No evil shall escape my sight. So it's pretty obvious that if you're not looking, it's going to escape your sight. And then Katma preaches to John later about how the Green Lanterns have to stand for honor and truth, but her entire reason for not going back, for not wanting to go back, is pretty self-serving, because she doesn't want John to learn that Hal was the former Green Lantern. And why that even matters at this point, I don't know. But she also says, they treated us badly, but we won out in the end, did we not? No, you didn't win. The Zamaronians stole your memories again and beamed you off planet. That's not winning. That's
it's rewriting history.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I know Englehart was facing some pretty tall orders when he came in, but
and then he had to get it to the Crisis, probably kind of quickly.
Right. Yeah. But this is just a pretty poor ending. Especially when I agree. He made real progress taking over the reins. As we mentioned last episode, things were actually getting better. But, I don't know. It's all the more frustrating because the issue that we get, or the story we get for the rest of this issue, while it was okay, wasn't one that needed to be told. So they had another 18 pages here. They could have wrapped up the Star Sapphire story better than just ending it 3 pages in. I did feel bad for John at the bottom of the page, though. I mean, you know that he's faced racism in his life, and then we had that great scene in issue 182 when we got the flashback to him getting the ring, where Katma was giving him troubles over being from Earth, and now the Zamaronians are looking down on him for being male. He just can't win. And while I would have liked for that to be explored more, I also like that it doesn't faze him, because I think that speaks a lot to John's character, that he's not going to let these incorrect judgments, you know, affect him personally. Page 5, unless it happened in an issue that I've not read, Katma never forgave Hal for the stunt he pulled, because at the end of the issue she didn't even know that Hal was behind it. I don't have a problem with writers revising history. I mean, the story they referenced here was from, like, Green Lantern number 30, so that's 20 years before this one. But it feels like they're revising something that just happened, because if she knew Hal was responsible, you'd think that would have come up when she was yelling at Hal for quitting the Corps.
Well, it's also possible that she forgave him in that moment, I've not read the issue itself, so I don't know what was said exactly in the issue. But I mean, I know that she did go on to be a teammate with him, and so she had to have forgiven him on some level or another. It wasn't until he gave up the ring for Carol that it all came back, and she got really mad.
Mm-hmm. And that issue, I actually pulled it back up and took a look at it. She was completely unaware.
Right.
But really, what did Hal do? He created the amoeba. He created the scenario, but the emotion sensor... Well, I'll get into that in my notes.
No, the emotion sensor from issue 30, that was ring-generated too.
So it could have been... I know it was ring-generated, but I didn't know if he tipped the scales. I did reading that, it didn't imply that he did.
I thought something on the last page when he was back... On the very last page of that story when he was talking to the Guardians, I thought there was something in there that mentioned it.
Maybe.
But again, I did like that they picked up panels from the original issue, whether they just grabbed the original art or State and redrew them, I don't know, like last issue, but I did like seeing the kind of more classic style.
Yeah, if Staten was doing that, which is entirely possible, then he did a really good job. It is possible that they're pulled, but I don't know. Again, I don't have the issue in front of me, but they would be very good facsimiles, especially since they're wearing the older-looking costumes.
Oh, with the sleeves that don't go... Yeah, without the sleeves, yeah.
They don't have the shoulder... They're not shoulder pads, but the shoulders go a bit longer.
Right.
For a more dynamic shape.
Page 7, we have another scene with Tom that makes absolutely no sense. Maybe even less so. Less than before, since Tom is finally reaching out to Hal, and Hal just hangs up on him and then wallows in self-pity over how he has no friends. But they do deal with that a little bit next issue, so we can come back to it then. Page 8, on a more positive note, I liked the art and the dialogue between John and Kat Mihir. It's a very playful scene, and even though, like I said last episode, it seems like their relationship has advanced too much, too fast, I'm enjoying the playfulness and kind of romanticism between the two of them, especially in contrast to what Hal and Carol have been going through. But did John just endorse lobotomies for everyone on Earth?
Pretty much.
In a sense, yeah.
Okay. That's got an entirely different connotation.
It could be one of those thinking out loud things that you then later realize, oh yeah, that really wouldn't be the best thing. Like, you know, it would be great if we just killed off the stupider half of the world population, but that's not nice.
And then John becomes a Sith Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Page 10, I've never read the original Replicon story. I'm really only familiar with the character when his son appeared in the Adventures of Superman when Greg Rucka was on the title, but he seems like an interesting villain, but he's really, really ridiculous looking.
A little bit.
Yeah. Not much else to say until we get over to page 15, though I did think the art was cool on these next few pages. Staten does really good fights and action, even if his humanoid figures look a little wonky sometimes. Page 15, this is Katma's speech that I was talking about. She says, John, our Corps is born and bred on honor. A Green Lantern should do everything he can to avoid lying. And yet, she wasn't exactly honest about why she didn't want to go back to Zamaron, and we find out later that she lied about knowing who Replicon was, possibly even to the point of luring John into his path. It's just bad writing, or someone needs to call Katma on her hypocrisy.
Yeah, at that as well as the fact that we just heard the story about when Hal Jordan lied to her with creating this amoeba. Now, Green Lanterns lie all the time. I'm kind of skipping into my own notes here, but Green Lanterns do lie all the time. I don't get why it has to be important in this moment. I realize that it does become part of the story. Like John says, hey, I have this idea. All I have to do is lie about it. It's not even that big of a deal. Replicon needs to be stopped from what he's doing. But then, of course, they end up doing something very good instead based on that honor code. But even so, it's just a ridiculous idea to have the honor code when it doesn't apply almost any other time.
Right. Pages 16 through 18, more punchy McFighty. Again, nice art, but not much to say. Page 19, the Guardians ask Katma how things are going, and she replies, quite well, Masters. Better, in fact, than I dared hope. Conveniently leaving out the part where she had to talked John out of lobotomizing everyone and had to teach him that lying was bad. Page 20. So they smashed the asteroids together to form this planet, one big enough to have its own gravity field and atmosphere. Wouldn't this have major effects on the other planets in the solar system?
Just a little bit, yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's, yeah, it would have an effect, but also one of the prevailing theories is that it was once a planet and something happened to it. Either it was unstable or something big hit it.
Right.
And so it potentially could still work in the solar system, but yeah, it would create some changes.
Page 22, we find out here that Katma isn't supportive of John's idea of lobotomizing everyone. Well, not because it's wrong, but because there might be unforeseen consequences. You know, somebody might have a car wreck or something. Never mind the fact that altering people's brains without their consent. And as I mentioned earlier, we learn here that Katma probably lied about knowing Replicon, but she says hopefully the ends justify the means. So that makes me ask, what makes the ends John was trying to accomplish any less honorable than hers?
Well, they would have taken longer. She'd be stuck there for 24 hours with nothing to read.
She needs to get an iPad so she can read comics.
Exactly.
In page 23, Guy Gardner. Yay! At least we're ending on a high note. Overall, I think the plot was fine. It was a nice idea, but it should have been next issue. We really needed a better conclusion to the Carol Ferris Predator stuff, and Cat Matui is just a big old truckload of hypocrisy all through the issue, which I could have done without, but...
Well, at some point, we have to return to Carol being Star Sapphire, because I think she's going to be Star Sapphire for a little while, if I remember correctly, but we're just not going to see her for a bit.
Right. But the story with the Predator and all that is effectively over.
Right.
So...
Well, we wrapped that up.
Good.
But that's all I had. Thankfully, I have much more positive things to say about the next two issues, which we'll get to here shortly. So what do you got, David?
Actually, once I put most of the complaints of we're getting right up to the climax of a story and then we just drop it, once I put that to the side, I kind of took the story itself on its own merit. And starting on page two, though, why did Katma set a distance limit on when the memories would return? Why not just back them up?
I think that the idea there was that then they could just be erased again if they were still there.
Okay.
And that way, once they were far enough away from the planet,
then they would remember it but not be able to do anything about it.
Well, they could still go back. But
there's no reason to go back because the Zamaronians didn't do anything.
Right. Well, that's actually my next note. On page four, they say they committed no crime that we know of. We're dealing with a race of people that manipulate memory. Just because you don't know of a crime doesn't mean there isn't one.
Exactly.
You were there for a reason, right? And I kind of mentioned Green Lantern number 30 with Katma Tui getting tricked by Hal. Have we ever mentioned that Katma was actually the replacement for Sinestro?
I don't think so.
Oh, yeah.
Until now.
She is. There you go. Moving to page six, Hal Jordan. He likes long walks on the beach, pork and beans from the can. Can you hear the sad piano music playing? It looks like a Valtrex commercial. You know, it's like, I have herpes, but you wouldn't know it. So I sit around lonely at night.
Yeah, Hal is basically eating bachelor chow. And...
Yeah.
I don't understand what... I mean... You can be a bachelor and still know some basics of cooking. I mean, yeah. You can know how to make eggs.
He's inherited Tom's emo fascination.
Pretty much.
Which is going to get funny next issue. Mm-hmm. But page eight, you mentioned this too, Michael. I love this page. This layout is awesome. Not only does it look awesome, it reads smoothly. I think that shows Staton's quality of storytelling. Because he made a talking head scene into a dynamic series of shots. And yeah, John poses that interesting argument about wiping prejudice from the minds of the universe, which is, yeah, it's a lobotomy. And true, it would be used for personal gain, but that opens the door to other possibilities. And it really shows how scary a Green Lantern who's driven in the wrong direction, like Sinestro, could be really dangerous. It actually makes the Green Lanterns that much scarier to me. that, yeah, we could do this if we wanted to. And it kind of goes more on the Guardian's shoulders. I know that there's limitations set on the rings, but just the potential of what he's carrying on his hand is staggering.
And there's really no limitations. I mean, that's what they've been drilling into him for the past few issues. The only limitation is himself.
Well,
other than Yellow.
Yellow, and at this point, I don't think the ring, they have still have the no kill on there.
Oh, okay.
So I think that there is a point. I think the Guardians can pull certain shenanigans. Page 11, Replicon. I kind of like you. He's goofy looking. He's kind of cool. I actually went back and read Green Lantern 108 and 109, as per the editor's note. That's where he actually replicated Batman, Flash, Wonder Woman. He actually, somewhere in there in his repertoire, is Black Canary's judo as well. And it was a pretty... I mean, he kind of puts it down right here that, yeah, I kind of wanted to steal the atmosphere, and that was what happened. And they didn't mention, though, that he actually courted Carol Ferris, and she was kind of into him for a brief moment.
Hmm.
Yeah, there's that. That's awkward. page 12, when Hal Jordan, or Replicon Jordan, takes off the ring from John, why doesn't his head explode, as in John's? The ring shouldn't still be protecting him, should it?
I'm with you on that, and I just kind of forgave it and said maybe they're on a... I don't know how I justified it in my head. There really is no good justification for it, but I guess it's how it's happening.
Okay.
Maybe the fact that the ring still has power and that it does belong to John is just keeping him alive by proxy.
I can buy that. Maybe they're replicating the it's maybe not something to think about too much. And yeah, I like that. Yeah, we pointed out the core is bound by honor and must tell the truth. Having a secret identity is already lying, and I know that comes back on characters, even Superman. But I understand that is a necessity. He's protecting his parents, his friends. But let's remember, yeah, Hal created the amoeba scenario. But it did show her the actual emotions, her loyalty to the core. But yeah, just by having a secret identity, John, or revealing his secret identity, John is actually two steps ahead of Katma right here. So point John. And then, of course, we have page 19 where the Guardians approve of romantic feelings between Green Lanterns. That's not a good sign. You know something's coming down the pike. That's not something that they do. And then, yeah, page 23, the countdown begins. I think that I agree with you guys. This issue didn't need to happen. It was a fill-in story. But if this had happened somewhere else, if we had this story not ignoring what had come before, it would be a good standalone issue, and it's firmly a John Stewart story. I know we check in on Hal, and we get the epilogue, but this was almost a very standard Silver Age-style Green Lantern story, and John actually got to the forefront for once and was the 99% of the focus. I know Katma was there, but it was his story, which I really liked.
Yeah, that was a good point. That is a good point, because the last few issues have been more focused on Hal's issue with John kind of being a side character.
Mm-hmm. And even though it's very much it's a standalone story and it is a little bit clunky, I guess I kind of see it as a segue between, okay, we've had this large arc that's been going on for a while and we're about to move into this huge crossover, so here's our chance to kind of decompress and have a standalone story. Although I do still agree that it just ends the Zamaron angle way too quickly.
Oh, easily. Yeah. That's not even up for debate. I mean, it's just let's bring it to a point and then just drop it.
Right.
But that's all I have beyond the Coen Brothers ending.
For me, I really dug this cover, especially since it would make me want to read the comic. Especially knowing that Hal Jordan was no longer Green Lantern, the prospect of him maybe coming back, even though we find out that it's Replicon. So it's a bit of a tease, and then the payoff is something that you wouldn't expect. And I generally tend to appreciate that kind of thing. You see that a lot in the Silver Age, in those rare moments where the comic actually does have something to do with this, with the cover, but that's different. But taking a look, I'm skipping the splash page entirely. Page two, I really like that this cool use of the ring to record their memories. I totally dig that.
Kind of like a black box.
Exactly. And so that they can then remember. Page four, I'm a little confused how John knows that Star Sapphire is Carol.
Yeah, he never came across her from that, because a good point.
I don't know from previous issues, previous appearances, how he might have been able to figure that out. And she does have a mask on, and I'm not saying that the mask would be a very effective way to hide one's identity, that kind of a mask. But a Green Lantern mask isn't a very effective way either. So just throwing that in there. Still on page four, I've come to really like this coupling with Cat Matui and John. And I do know what's going to happen eventually. I just don't know when. And that I just have to leave where it is until we get to it. Page five, I would like to go back and read this story. You said it was issue 30.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to go back and read some old Green Lantern. And maybe before, maybe after I do the full Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover, which I've just been meaning to do for a long time, and I think I'm finally going to do it since we are beginning to talk about it. Unfortunately, it's not going to help us out with this episode we're recording right now. Page six. Okay, I get that Hal's eating bachelor food, but use a microwave or a stove. put it in a bowl, something. I mean, but I guess it is showing some level of depression. Like, I'm too lazy to do anything more than open the can. Page eight. I love this conversation with John about the prejudice from Earth, because in a way, it's kind of a good idea. But the thing is, Katma is right that it would be like the Zamorans. It would be something intended for good, but it would be an act of evil. Because when it comes down to it, society needs to get there organically. And I'm not saying that prejudice is gone now in 2012, but it's better than it was in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to get better. I mean, it appears to be that it's just getting better. And it's unfortunate for the people who have to live through it now, or the people who had to live through it then. And I'm not trying to say anything that would make that smaller than what it is. But when we get there, that's an accomplishment. And the fact that the idea of actually mind wiping people in order to bring them there very well could be detrimental to society. But there you go.
Well, yeah, because you don't have the natural evolution to back it up. You don't have any frame of reference for where you've been.
And David, you mentioned that the layout on page eight is really nice. I really like this layout as well. And it's because it looks so good that I am totally willing to forgive that nothing is to scale at all.
Yeah.
from Jupiter, it should be very, very difficult to see Mars. It would look like a star. It would not be as bright as it is, especially since the sun would be shining on the other side of it. You'd be seeing the dark side of Mars at that point. And the asteroid belt, basically the way that it works out in the real solar system is that Mercury is so far away from the sun, Venus is twice as far as that from the sun, Earth is twice as far as that, Mars is twice as far as that, then the asteroid belt is twice as far as that, and Jupiter is twice as far as that. So we're looking at a really big distance. Mars is farther away from Jupiter than the sun is from Earth. It would be a speck. But again, I'm willing to forgive that because it's just the layout as it is and the way that they go about it, it works really well. Page nine. I just, as I was reading this and taking notes for the first time, not knowing that that was Replicon, I just put down Batman. And actually, he reminds me more of Azrael Batman, who has not been introduced yet. He's a good 6 or 7 years away from being introduced. But then it's revealed, oh, it's Replicon. Yeah, that makes sense. And then this whole fight, I pretty much skipped. I just didn't have a lot to say about it. So page 14, the way Replicon describes the asteroid belt and its origin is pretty much the prevalent idea for where the asteroid belt came from. I kind of mentioned that earlier. Page 15, I'm just going off what my notes were. Green Lanterns can't lie? Oh, that's just stupid. There's the whole deal with secret identities, Hal creating the giant amoeba thing in the flashback of this issue, the fact that there's a lie later on in the issue. Green Lanterns lie all the time. Please. And jumping ahead a little bit more to page 19, I had to stop and think about that too. David mentioned this, but wait, the Green Lanterns approve of Cat Matui and John dating? Not only approve, but say, yes, this is a good thing. Not, yes, we will allow it, but yes, this is a good thing. That's just kind of weird.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to the last few pages before the epilogues, what a weird ending.
With the yeah, I forgot to make them. Did you ever see the movie Enemy Mine with James Earl Jones and Dennis Quaid?
No, I've not seen that one.
They kind of did a Star Trek episode that was like it. It's two alien species, a human and another alien, trapped on a planet together who are kind of pitted against each other. They form an odd friendship, and then the male of the species apparently gives birth. So there's an awkward birthing scene between the two of them, and that's what it made me think of.
Yep. And then page 22, we get that Katma was deceiving John and then went off about Green Lanterns not lying. And ultimately, there is now a new planet in the solar system in the DC universe, which I don't think ever gets... I mean, it may get talked about again at some point, but in many of the DC books continuing after this. Then again, we do have a crisis coming up, so they kind of reboot almost everything at that point anyway.
They do but make a casual reference of it next issue, but
okay.
After yes. that, yeah.
Well, it's not really going to be around that. I mean, sorry, spoilers, crisis will pretty much eradicate that, pretty I would much. Assume.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a really good explanation now that I think of it. I didn't think of that when I was taking the notes. The two epilogues, interesting, both of them. I have to wonder, since normally comics are 22 pages at this point, even though the Green Lantern books do seem to be 23, this does seem as though it could have been tacked on. Like, oh yeah, we need to do stuff about the crisis, and we already have 22 pages. Because that could have been... The end of page 22 could have been the end of the story, except we have these two epilogues to bring us into what we're going to be getting into next issue. Because we already had Guy wake up. We don't need him checking out of the hospital.
Right.
And as far as the Guardians go with the Green Lantern battery, this really just ties into the crisis, and it just brings us into that. And so it felt as though this could have been a tacked on page. And the sky is red, and that's important.
Mm-hmm.
Even though when we get into the next issue, we'll find out that it's going to lead into crisis number two, I think, which is, let's see, I think crisis 8 was released between this one and the next one. So they do a little bit of backtracking. There is a little bit of skipping around in there.
A little bit?
A little bit.
We'll see that next issue, though.
All right, well, there's nothing much of note in the letter column. I was looking at it just now, and I did see a guy wrote in that mentioned the Broome Memorial Hospital that we talked about, and he also mentions a Sprang Arena and Finger Alley. Of course, he says over in Gotham City, so maybe those were references to the Batman books. But if they were mentioned in the Green Lantern books, I totally missed them. We are going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with Crisis Talk and a look at Green Lantern number 194.
Enjoy time travel in general and the Silver Age of comic books in particular? If so, join me each week on the Superman Fan Podcast. My name is Billy Hogan, and I will be your host. Together, we'll crash through the time barrier and fly into the past to explore the Silver Age adventures of Superman. One week we will take a look at the Superman family of titles, Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, World's Finest Comics, and soon, Superman's girlfriend Lois Lane. The next week we will feature the Man of Steel's titles, Superman and Action Comics, which will include the Supergirl stories during her run in the back of that title. You can join me each week on Wednesday or Thursday at the supermanfanpodcast.blogspot.com, which is available on iTunes. And your emails are always welcome at supermanfanpodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to wear your red indestructible cape.
And coming back, before we get to Green Lantern 194, we have to set up the Crisis on Infinite Earths, because this issue is a tie-in. Now, Crisis on Infinite Earths was a 12-issue maxi-series published from April 1985 to March 1986. Now, the month that this issue came out, cover month, Crisis on Infinite Earths was already on issue number 8. So we're already coming towards the conclusion. In terms of our chronology within what we're reading, issue one hasn't happened yet when we open up this issue. So from our coverage standpoint, Crisis on Infinite Earths begins with this issue, continues to the next, and then really kind of rears up again in 198 with some pretty interesting repercussions. Now, kind of to give you some background continuity-wise, Crisis comes from the fact that DC had such a long publishing history going all the way back to the 1930s that to keep things aligned and justify some of the older stories, keep them kind of in play, there were multiple Earths, hence the title. These were all our planet, the same location, but they moved at different vibrational speeds. So the Golden Age happened on Earth 2. On Earth 3, the heroes and villains were inverted, so Green Lantern is Power Ring there, and he is a villain. These Earths formed what is known as the multiverse, and we first saw that emerge in Flash number 123 with the Flash of Two Worlds story. And basically just with this setup, we would get sometimes a Justice League, Justice Society crossover. We would have books like the All-Star Squadron and Infinity Inc. that took place in the Golden Age era of Earth. Story-wise, the reason for the multiverse lies in the hands of Krona, who was a scientist of Oa, who decided he wanted to see the creation of the universe and actually built a machine to take him there. But as the universe was coming to being, this machine exploded and created infinite parallel universes. So that is the core story-wise. Krona was published by being turned into pure energy, and the event inspired the Owens to become the Guardians of the Universe and eventually create the Green Lantern Corps. See how that all connects? It also brought about the creation of a character called the Monitor, who is essentially the living embodiment of positive matter universes. And Monitor was born on Oa's moon. On the flip side, it also brought about a similar being on a moon of Kord, which is Oa's antimatter counterpart. And this being was known as the Anti-Monitor. These two battled each other for a million years and then pretty much knocked each other unconscious for 9 billion years until Anti-Monitor awoke and began destroying these multiple universes one by one, filling the gap with antimatter. Now, seeing the threat, the Monitor began mounting a defense using the help of a girl named Lila, who we've seen, who is kind of his adopted daughter or potentially a girlfriend. We're never really clarified on that, or maybe both. And they began supplying technology and support to villains of multiple Earths to test the heroes. And as the universes began to die, Monitor actually sends Lila, aka Harbinger, to gather the worthy heroes to stop the Anti-Monitor from destroying all positive matter universes, which is right about where we are when issue 194 begins. Now, internally, does that cover everything, Jeffrey?
Pretty much.
Okay. I didn't know if there was... I kind of tried to keep as streamlined as I could, but tell everything I could, so...
Right. And then there's the story of where the crisis came from story-wise, where it was really Marv Wolfman who had the idea to do it and take all of these multiple Earths and do a larger story that would include all of them, and it eventually turned into it sort of snowballed into something that got bigger and bigger and bigger over time, especially as it was gearing up for the first issue release. And what it really came down to was that the decision came down that DC was going to reboot pretty much its entire universe. And by reboot, I don't even mean the New 52. This was a bigger reboot than that. When it comes down to it, they were taking all of these multiple Earths and they were trying to find an organic way to bring them all into one Earth. The reason for this was because the DC universe had become so convoluted with all the different Earths and all the different stories that it actually was alienating readers, especially new readers, which has always been a point of contention for the entire comic book industry. Now, fortunately, this was the 80s. You could do that kind of thing and get a lot of new readers. Now they do the New 52. The numbers are still not nearly what they were at this time or in the 90s or even going back to the 70s or 60s, and especially not as big as it was in the 50s. In the early 50s, that was the biggest time for comic books ever, and things were a lot simpler back then. So it was an attempt to simplify the DC universe, and we got a new story for the explanation of where Wonder Woman came from, and she started over with a new number one after the series ended. Superman did the same thing. We had the Man of Steel miniseries, and once again, by the time Crisis came out, practically half of Krypton survived the explosion of the planet. And when we got back after Crisis on Infinite Earths, Superman was literally the last son of Krypton. In fact, during Crisis on Infinite Earths, they killed off not the original Flash, who would be Jay Garrick, but the Silver Age Flash, the one who spawned the beginning of the Silver Age, Barry Allen, and made Kid Flash into the new Flash, and he got a new number one as well. One of the ones who was in some ways the least affected was Batman. But Green Lantern was certainly affected by this, as we're going to see as we go through. So I don't want to spoil too far ahead on that. And
they weren't affected in the same way Superman was, because there's no clear line of demarcation between the post-crisis Green Lantern and pre-crisis Green Lantern.
No, but they did start up a new title with the continuing numbering, and it actually did continue the story in a very similar way. But Crisis on Infinite Earths is a really good story. It's very well done. The only problem is, if you are not familiar with at least a good handful of the characters, it can be very, very confusing.
Yes.
Because it jumps around. It basically takes the entire DC universe from the time, puts them into one very large story, and you have to try and keep track of them all. Now, if you were to try to read the entire Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover, that would be quite a feat. From what I'm seeing here, from what DC actually put out as their ultimate list of books, including all 12 issues of the Crisis, you would have a minimum of 147 books to read. And that's not including how it did continue on to the next big crossover that they did in 1987, which was called Legends. And of course, Crisis did spawn several sequels, Legends being one of them, Zero Hour being in a roundabout way a sequel to Crisis, even though it's no longer thought of being that way, because Crisis also created some serious issues. For instance, one of my personal favorites is Donna Troy, because Donna Troy was Wonder Girl, the younger sidekick to Wonder Woman. They rebooted Wonder Woman after Crisis on Infinite Earths, and it turned out that she was just now appearing in the modern world. She was just coming from Themyscira for the first time, and this is years after Superman and Batman had already been doing their business, so to speak. And when it came to Donna Troy, she was in a very successful series called The New Teen Titans. And so they didn't want to mess with her character too much. But she was still Wonder Woman's sidekick. So how do you be Wonder Woman's sidekick if Wonder Woman hasn't been in the world? And so they tried to correct a lot of the little mistakes that they just didn't quite fix with Legends. They tried to fix a lot with Zero Hour, and every time that they did, they would find that they were making more mistakes, which is part of why we get more and more crises.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, the real direct sequel to this was 20 years later with Infinite Crisis, which we are still far from doing.
Yeah.
Just a couple of episodes.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the most that I really want to say about getting into it. And I did talk a little bit about the aftermath, but I'll get more into the aftermath when we actually finish it up.
Yeah.
Before we get into the episode, you brought up something. In your guys' opinion, do you think that if you would hand someone the Crisis on Infinite Earths trade, someone who isn't steeped in comics, that they would be completely lost?
Yes. I think.
Oh, yeah. Completely lost. Even somebody who has moderate knowledge, I wouldn't say they'd be lost, but there are characters that, I mean, Psycho Pirate. I didn't know who he was before this. So, I mean, it's a dense read. There's pretty much every character. And you get into even like the Western characters and the war type characters. It's incredible.
Well, at least they didn't go back to the romance characters from the 50s and 60s.
No.
But... I would have to go with that. The idea that somebody who does not already know a good deal about the universe would have a hard time with it. And I say that as somebody who I read this for the first time in, I want to say, 2003. I'd never read it before that. I was a huge Superman fan and huge into the DCU, especially in the early to mid 90s. And I had gotten back into comics and gotten heavily back into the entire post-Crisis history. And then I tried to finally read this. And it took two readings to really get what was going on because it was difficult, especially keeping track of all the characters, knowing which characters are which. Some of them are important. Some of them just have one or two quick scenes. But what do the scenes even matter if you don't know who they are or what they're doing? It's very confusing, and this is not something that I would hand to somebody who did not already have a... I came in with a good background of who a lot of these characters were, and I was confused. I would not hand this to somebody who didn't know anything beyond I like Superman and Batman and the Justice League.
Hmm. And I'd almost say that's a compliment to the book itself because it really was you wouldn't see this now because you would have to spoon feed it to a lot of audiences. And this was something built for fans. This was something that was built specifically for people who had been reading the books as a almost maybe a bit of closure by happenstance.
Yes, and again, that was not the original intent when Marv Wolfman was pitching it all the way back in 1984.
Mm-mm.
And that's kind of interesting. Now, if you have the issues themselves instead of the trade paperback, DC was trying a new printing format. And I think it's the first issue, and I think also the second issue, look very, very strange in their pages because things did not quite match up the way that they wanted them to. And it was the worst possible time to try and make a major change in how you go about printing color in your comics. But they pretty much – they either fixed it or they went back by issue 3. I can't remember which. But it is very much fixed for all the trade paperbacks. I think there's an absolute edition as well. And if you are a fan of DC, you should try to know a little bit more than just Green Lantern. It's definitely worth the read in that case. And don't feel bad if you are just a little bit lost and you need to come back to it. And don't forget that this was a major milestone, not only because it recreated the DC Universe for what was my favorite era of it, but it also kills off Barry Allen, even though he is now back alive. I sort of thought of him as one of the ones that you can't really bring back necessarily, and they eventually did. and also Supergirl, the original Kara Zor-El Supergirl, who looked a bit different. Her costume had changed by this time, but you'll still recognize her pretty easily. Mm-hmm. And they didn't bring her back. The idea that Superman was not the actual last Kryptonian, at least from his own universe, was not introduced until 2002, 2003 with Superman Batman number 7.
Yes. Well, let's dive into the issue, kind of see where our story takes us into the crisis. This is issue 194, which was cover dated November 1985, would have been on stands August 15th of the same year. It is simply titled 5, written by Steve Englehart, penciled by Joe Staton, inked by Bruce Patterson, lettered by L. Lois Buhalis, colored by Anthony Tolan, edited by Andrew Helfer. Cover was done, of course, by Joe Staton and Bruce Patterson. And it shows John and Katma firing green power beams at a costumed blonde woman who we will come to know as Harbinger, with John saying, "Forget it, Harbinger, you're not taking us anywhere." Oh, yeah, and a huge image of the monitor's face in the background. Did you guys have any comments on the cover?
I didn't, actually.
No, I just had a comment on the fact that it was called number 5, or just called 5. Because the next issue we're going to talk about is number 4, and then when we get into the next episode, we will have three stories which are titled 3, 2, and 1.
Yes, it's a countdown to issue 200.
Yep.
And we are told right up front, as far as our timeline, that this is July of 1985, and we start in Star City, where Black Canary and Green Arrow are rescuing a woman from a collapsing building and are almost buried beneath the rubble as it falls, but at a last minute, Katma Tui and John Stewart rescue the heroes.
I do think it's worth mentioning at this point, since you're doing the recap, that for those who are following along, that this takes place, as far as I can tell, it leads into issue 2 of Crisis on Infinite Earths.
It leads into issue 1.
Oh, it leads into issue 1? Okay, so it takes place before issue 1 even.
Yeah, this takes place right before issue 1. It's actually, I got a note on that.
Okay.
John explains that they've just gotten back from space, and they were surprised to find that there are red skies covering the whole planet, and storms and earthquakes that seem to be striking, so they sought out Green Arrow and Black Canary to try to see if they knew what's going on. Unfortunately, they don't. They don't know a thing beyond a report that Firestorm vanished out east. But you know who does know what's going on? Harbinger, who shows up in her sort of new gods-looking outfit, coming to take John away. John tells Harbinger he's not going with her and tries to hold her in a ring construct vice grip, demanding answers. But Harbinger just breaks out of the hold, and a very short fight ensues in which ends with John deciding to go with Harbinger after all, to heed the summons of the monitor. Katma insists on going with him, but Harbinger's orders were to bring this one Green Lantern. So John puts the mask back on at Harbinger's insistence and heads off to parts unknown to deal with the crisis. And before we get to that, that'll lead us right into issue 1. Before we jump into that, we switch scenes to Hal Jordan at Ferris Aircraft, outside the fence, still lonely and forlorn, listening to some Tori Amos and thinking of Carol. And Hal's about to go to Tony's bar and deal with his own issues, which may end up being cirrhosis on Infinite Earths, when Talas Kamaki shows up. Thomas offers apologies and reveals that he is reunited with his estranged wife, Tegra, and their children. And the secret that Thomas has been working on in his garage isn't a compilation CD of emo hits. It was a new engine to add boost to NASA shuttles, and it looks like it will make Thomas rich. So Hal and Thomas make nice, and everybody's a little bit happier on the ground. Meanwhile, in space, we enter the monitor satellite, where John is brought to the Gathering of Heroes, which is a scene that comes directly from pages 26 and 27 of Crisis on Infinite Earths, number 1. John is in a very large chamber with heroes like Geo-Force, Cyborg of the Teen Titans, the Earth 2 Superman, Obsidian, among others. And then Shadow Demons, which are Anti-Monitor's foot soldiers, attack out of nowhere, and John and the other battle them, which is continuing in issue 1. Back here, we switch scenes again to Katma sending an energy twin to Oa to warn the Guardians of Harbinger's words, and the Guardians seem alarmed at the name of Monitor, and they've been getting reports of antimatter anomalies. And so the Guardians send Katma back to Earth, and she's naturally unnerved that the Guardians just weren't really fully aware of what's going on, since they normally are. She then decides to warn Dalor, but finds that when his whole section is gone. And by gone, I mean there's literally nothing there. And what freaks her out is that is a neighboring sector. So the danger is that close. So Katma flies off to check one more thing, leaving Ollie and Dinah to fear the worst, as well they should. Back on the satellite, the fight with the shadow demons ends abruptly with a bright light, and the monitor reveals himself to be to the gathering of heroes as the shadows disappear. And he lays the news on them that this universe is about to die. But they can join together and fight the anti-monitor. So the heroes agree, and they are teleported to five crucial battlegrounds, which is a scene directly out of Crisis on Infinite Earths number 2. Back on Oa, the Guardians are fretting about how they didn't see this crisis coming, and they need to gather their core, when a voice calls from the main battery, "You shall no more summon your soldiers than prove a threat to my plans." And a mighty blast of energy erupts from the battery, knocking all of the Guardians to the ground. Quick note, that also took place in Crisis number 2. Katma visits Hal to see if he can shed any light on the current state of things, but Hal has nothing. However, he and Katma do make peace, and Katma decides they want to be friends, and then with that, she leaves. And this prompts Hal to drive to the grave of Abin Sur, where he finds somebody desecrating the burial site, trying to dig up the body, apparently, and it turns out to be Guy Gardner, looking for the power to become Green Lantern. So Hal and Guy fight, which is fairly short-lived because a Guardian arrives and explains that they woke Guy up from his coma to make him a Green Lantern again. Hal protests, leaping at Guy and the Guardian just as they teleport to Oa, and in a flash of green light, everybody disappears as the issue closes with the night sky over Abin Sur's grave.
It's so funny. Reading through this, it reminds me how much I love Crisis on Infinite Earths. It's just been a long time since I've read the whole thing, so I'm not getting every single reference and where it actually belongs. But like I said, I'm going to read through the entire crossover sometime. I don't think I'll have it done by the next episode, but that's okay.
If you did, that would be above impressive.
Well, I did. The last time that I read this, I remember it was around February of 2006. And that same day, I think I woke up that morning and I was just home. I didn't have the car to use. And so I was just home. No car, no TV, no nothing. But I had a whole bunch of comic books because I always do. And I read through Wolverine, the Wolverine origin story. It's just called Origin. Mm-hmm. Then I read through this and then I followed that up with Superman Secret Identity. All of which I had read before, but I just felt like reading stuff that I loved.
That's a heck of a read.
Yeah. Yeah, and this was in the middle.
Wow.
Yeah, so.
Well, are you starting us off? Yeah,
I might as well start us off. It's but like I said, it has been a couple of years since I read it, and I feel like I should have reread it, but I'm going to get there. Jumping into the story itself, page 5, because I'm not going to start. I don't really have anything to say about the very, very beginning. I love that the Green Arrow, Black Canary, that ruse about the Trank Arrow. So that, I'm going to use the Trank Arrow. And that means the Black Canary can attack while the person is off guard.
Mm-hmm. I had a note about that too.
Okay. I just thought that was awesome. I love it. It's very comic booky. It would not work in live action. I mean, you could get it to work in live action, but the way that it works in a comic book just tickles me. I can't explain it. Also on page 5, all that I can say to Katma, where Katma's trying to talk to Harbinger and say, well, look, I'm the experienced one. I'm the one that you should want. Katma, back off. You're being a bitch.
When she's not entirely wrong, though.
No, I know. But, I mean, she's still – that Harbinger is there to get a specific person. Now, since Crisis on Infinite Earths came out before John took off the mask, he's had this whole time in Crisis where he's been wearing the mask. So this is just a way to get it to match up. It's a little bit clunky, but I can't see a better way to do it.
Right.
And so it's just one of those storytelling things, and I'm glad that they did it instead of having him have the mask in Crisis and then in the Green Lantern comics, he doesn't have the mask because it wouldn't match up that way. So I really dig that they actually took the time to do that. I wish there was a way to do it that wasn't so clunky, but I don't see what that could have been.
And of all the stuff they had to keep track of with Crisis, I think something like that could have easily fallen through the cracks. So it's
yes, definitely.
Impressive bit of attention to continuity.
Page 8? Oh, something seems creepy about Pie Face. But maybe it's just me. This whole situation, it just came out of nowhere. And by the time you get to page 9, yeah, everything, it just came out of nowhere, and it just seems creepy and weird, and like this is some alien took over Pie Face and his family, and they're trying to convince Hal of something. I don't understand what the point of this is. I mean, maybe it'll come up later on. I know it doesn't come up in the next issue we'll be talking about this episode, but it's just so weird to deal with this now. And it really did come out of nowhere. The last time that we saw him, people were trying to break into his house for some reason that we never got into. I don't know. Maybe it will resolve itself in a way that will make sense. But for right now, it just seems weird and creepy.
Really convenient, too.
Exactly. Oh, incredibly convenient. And had nothing to do with the story. Pages 10 through 12. This all seems pretty different from what I remember on Crisis. Or am I kind of thinking about it the wrong way? I'm not really sure.
10 and 11 was pretty not quite exact, but really, really close.
Okay, fair enough. Because I don't remember all these characters being together in exactly that way, or maybe there were more characters or less characters.
There were a lot more characters in that.
So maybe Crisis. This is right before they all convened, as they all do when there's a big crossover like that. When I think of a whole bunch of characters convening for here's the big speech about how we need to go and help the world or the universe, I always think of Panic in the Sky. Mm-hmm. That one like 2-page spread of all the heroes. And we do kind of get that in Crisis. And here we just get a few of them. Let's see. I see Geo-Force, Cyborg, there's Psycho Pirate, the Earth 2 Superman. I see Blue Beetle. I think that's Hawkman. It's hard to tell.
No, that's
Dawnstar.
Yeah, from
Dawnstar. Okay. Oh, that's Dawnstar. Okay. I just saw the wings, and you cannot see a face at all. And then I'm not positive about these other two. The one with the red cape. It almost looks like Steel.
No,
but
it's
not.
It's Solivar from Gorilla City.
Oh, I got you. Okay, so he's not flying. He's okay.
Right.
And who is this who we have the back to that Earth 2 Superman is talking to?
Obsidian.
That is Obsidian. Okay. That was my first thought, but then I'm like, wait, what, why would it be Obsidian? Why would he even be there?
There you go. If you look at that scene in Crisis 1, it's a lot clearer who everybody is.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
I wish I had the Wizard issue because there was an annotated Crisis issue where they went through several pages and kind of named everybody that was in the big gathering scenes.
Gotcha.
As much as I like Joe Staton, he's no George Perez as far as grouping.
Well, there you go. And this does go all the way back to the beginning of the Crisis, which was many months before this, as we've all mentioned. Mm-hmm. But given how this month's Crisis on Infinite Earths number 9 begins, it clearly catches up fast.
Yes.
That's going to take place right after this issue and then lead into the next issue of Green Lantern. So we don't get 8 issues of Crisis in one Green Lantern. We just get the beginning and then skip ahead. And the idea behind Crisis is that it happens very quickly. And so that's okay. It's just a question of getting the books out in a certain time. Then you got to figure out the order, which, again, does exist. Maybe we should have a link to it at Green Lantern's Light, the reading list for anybody who's interested.
We can do that.
Okay. Page 15, where all the Guardians get the power battery basically erupts and all the Guardians get hit by it. My note, because I didn't remember that even happened in issue 2 and I had not read ahead yet, my note was, okay, that's not good. Did all the Guardians just die? But no, that is clearly not the case. They've just been knocked down, which is also kind of unheard of. That takes an immense amount of power to knock out all the Guardians like that.
They get knocked down, but they get up again.
Never gonna keep them down.
Page 16. my inner child. Page 18, we do have this line of, you know, once a Green Lantern, always a Green Lantern. And Katma Tui is saying to Hal, you know, you were a Green Lantern, but you still are a Green Lantern. Once a Green Lantern, always a Green Lantern. So it is kind of like the Marine Corps. We had a conversation back in episode 8 about how it wasn't like the Marine Corps. Because he's not a Green Lantern anymore. Can't call himself a Green Lantern. But once a Green Lantern, always a Green Lantern. Make up your damn mind! Because we're trying to talk about it. You need to keep in mind that people are going to podcast about this stuff at some point. Anyway, page 20. Hal just sucker punches Guy. Because he's going to visit the grave of Abin Sur, which I'm still kind of torn on. Like, there's a crisis going on. I better go to the cemetery. It's not a cemetery. It's just where Abin Sur happens to be buried. But that just bugs me. But what bugs me a lot more is that Hal gets there and Guy is there trying to dig up Abin Sur because he thinks that the ring is under there. And what does Hal do? He just whacks him in the face. And I hate it when, you know, these heroic characters like Hal Jordan go directly to that. They can't use their words. This is the kind of thing that in real life, if you just did that, you'd go to jail. Rightfully so, because you are a violent person who cannot control his anger.
I had a similar note.
Okay, good. It always bugs me, and I'm always going to point it out when it happens. And in this case, I might expect it from Guy. He hasn't quite gotten to that point yet. They're starting to round out his character and who he's going to be, and that he's a little bit impulsive and, you know, does some things that people might consider to be weird, but in fact he does have some idea. In his mind, it makes sense. And that's who Guy is going to end up being. And he's not all the way there right now. I can see Guy doing that to Hal. Hal doing that to Guy makes Hal a jerk. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
Although I will take the exception somewhere later on down the road, Batman is going to just punch Guy in the face and it's... but the final page, page 23, great ending. And I'm really, really glad based on this because when the Guardian shows up and takes Guy back to Oa and Hal gets sucked into it or makes himself get sucked into it so that he can also go. It's such a great ending, and I'm really glad that I don't have to wait a month to see where it goes.
Yeah, I really like this ending too. It got me really excited to read the next issue.
And then nothing happens in the next issue. It's about a page, and then we're on to something. Oh, just kidding.
To get into my notes, this was actually an interesting read. I mean, having read Crisis several times, it was really kind of neat to get an expanded look at John's involvement in those first few issues, or maybe not an expanded look, but a different look at his involvement. Page 4, I liked Black Canary's comment, "Woman," when she's talking to Harbinger. Pages 4 and 5, Harbinger is pretty freaking awesome. I don't remember getting the impression from Crisis itself that she was such a strong fighter. And I don't mind it, it makes sense, but I didn't remember getting that impression. Jumping ahead to page 8, after a really heavy-handed scene with Hal in a bar, we get the return of Tom Kamaku. And Englehart just sweeps all that stuff with him being annoyed with Hal under the rug with one line of dialogue. Now, granted, it was stupid to begin with, but it just feels like it was brushed away far too easily. Like, he just didn't want to deal with it, so he just sweeps it under the rug. Page 9, Tom says he almost enjoyed the pain when Tegra took the kids, so he's emo and a masochist. Very good. Page 11, I wish these folks would stop taking the most powerful weapon in the universe and aiming it directly at their foreheads.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah, I had a note on that.
Page 14, so if the ring can detect if people are lying, wouldn't that have been a useful feature last issue when Katma lied to John, or maybe when Hal lied to Katma about her fiancé? They seem very inconsistent about the whole Green Lanterns and lying, and it's very weird. Page 15, John says, I don't have my choice of assignments. Exactly. You fight wherever the evil is. Now go back to Zamaron and take care of the Star Sapphire. Page 9, something good just happened. Let's go tell Avansar's grave. And the reward for most ridiculous line of dialogue goes to... Yeah. Page 22, in order to fight the crisis that they didn't see coming, which was caused by a power they didn't detect, they fanned the spark of life in Guy Gardner 4 or 5 issues ago. Right. No one else has a problem with that?
No, I do. I agree with you completely. I had a similar note because, yeah, let's get the unbalanced comatose guy to hook us up for the crisis that we didn't know about.
I'm completely on board. Yeah. I think it makes perfect sense. I'm being sarcastic.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Page 23, Hal calls the Guardian Master, and Katma did it last issue. That's very uncomfortable, and I'm guessing we're not going to see John do that.
Yes, Amasa.
So what did you have, David?
Oh, I didn't see that coming. I'm sorry.
That was pretty awesome. I think that's our quote for the episode.
I'm just saying that I don't think we're going to see John doing it. Yeah.
I hope not. I start on page 5. What exactly changed John's mind as far as going with Harbinger? I mean, maybe it was all this fighting. We can't really do much about it, but it just seems like an odd sudden shift.
I can see that as a new Green Lantern, somebody shows up and says, there's a major multiversal crisis and we need you, that you say, well, I guess that you need me, so I'll do what you need me to do. I mean, I can justify it as a new Green Lantern. I don't think that Hal should have necessarily done the same thing, although he probably would have.
Maybe.
In brightest day, in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight.
No intolerant shall escape. Yeah. No intolerant shall escape my sight. Let those who worship. Never mind.
Yeah. Page 7. I mean, I know we talked about how the previous story ended, and it was awkward. And I know we're kind of – a lot of the delays that we saw, a lot of the fill-ins, I know they contributed to the odd pacing as far as coming in late. But people forget that even though they did the best that they could, we kind of touched on Crisis was a little bit of a mess. It had a lot of things that didn't go quite right. I mean, overall, for the scope, it came off really well, but – so here we are. I mean, Crisis is at issue 8 comes out this calendar month. Issue 9 is what we're going to see next calendar month. So
yes, that's correct. And what's interesting about Crisis, I didn't really touch on this so much, was that things changed while it was coming out. Mm-hmm. And so Crisis itself, as a 12-issue maxi series, went through some changes during its run.
Editorial they were not on the spot fixes.
Yeah, they were not necessarily huge to the point of needing to change the story, like go back and pull a George Lucas or anything. And they don't with the trade. Thank goodness. But if you do try to read through the whole thing, there are changes in the middle of it, even. But they're
suddenly
mostly
Pariah Blinks.
Yeah. Well, they try to make it as organic as possible.
And they do fairly well. Yes, you're referring to sort of the Alexander Luthor.
That's part of it. Yes.
Yeah. That's what I kind of noticed that. Page 9. I will, as you've seen, I'll typically look up older issues if I have them. If it's referenced in an editor's note, just to enrich the reading experience. But here on that panel, it is probably the most editorial asterisks I've seen ever in a single panel. So clearly, I didn't go back to all of these. So,
right.
Page 10, I like that John's scanning the environment, kind of pointing his ring upward. If you look at that big splash page in Crisis number 1, that's actually what he's doing. So we actually get a correct positioning. And for somebody who has CDO, that's what I'm talking about. Let's get it exactly right. So as for some of the problems Crisis had, like moments like this where it syncs up perfectly, is what makes that an event. And we hadn't seen an event like that, not on that scale. We hadn't had a Secret Wars, had we? Secret Wars was same year, wasn't it?
Secret Wars came after.
Okay.
I thought Secret Wars came out in 1984, or was it 86?
Okay, I was wrong. Secret Wars came before Crisis.
Okay, touche.
But Crisis set the tone for what a crossover needed to be. And in fact, if you do go back to Green Lantern, I think the first time that we really see the Monitor is in one of the Green Lantern books, one of the early ones that we talked about.
He's a shadow figure. Yep.
Right. That, I mean, the crossover, if you think of it as every time the Monitor is seen, it's part of the crossover, then the crossover did begin first, but Secret Wars was going on at the same time.
But this was a scope that I don't... Even reading them both, Crisis is
Secret
on
Wars
scope.
Did not go to this scope, no. Secret no. Wars went on its own, and then suddenly all the Marvel books said, oh, Secret Wars happened.
Yeah, that yep. happened. Pages 13 and 14, kind of continuing that same thought process. This is an excellent condensed version of the events in Crisis 1 and 2. And you really could go through a massive event at this time, and you had all the tie-ins. But as far as if you're reading Green Lantern or if you're reading Superman, it stayed self-contained. You didn't have to read the main book, or you didn't have multiple tie-in miniseries to expand on it like we do now. So that's another big kudos, something that I do miss in crossovers, when you could just not buy 18 other books.
And by the time you get to Infinite Crisis, which is more of the direct sequel that I was talking about earlier, you had four miniseries which tied in directly to the beginning of Infinite Crisis, plus a fifth one which tied in I guess you could think of it as a roundabout way. It should have been like the fifth crossover miniseries. So you had four six-issue miniseries that led up to it, plus a single four-issue miniseries, which was the DC Presents Donna Troy, where they were trying to finally fix her character again.
It didn't work. Just
I think they managed it in that last attempt.
They got it as good as it's going to get. So.
Exactly.
On page 18, I like the flat. Well, once again, we're flashing back to Green Lantern number 30. I'm also really glad to see this fence mended. And it seems like it was organic. It's a realistic reason for Catman to change her viewpoint, because Hal really is kind of a pitiful character at this time. So kind of wrapping it up on page 20, Guy is digging up Abin Sur's body. Guy would know that Abin Sur's ring isn't there. Even, I know he's been in a coma, I know this, but he still clearly has memories of when the ring chose him, so...
Yeah, that could be explained away. Next issue, they talk about how he's not quite right yet.
You think? So let's slap a power ring on him.
Well, yeah.
But that's all I had. There was a lot that happened in this issue. It was very packed, and I enjoyed the heck out of it.
All right, well, there is actually no letters page in this issue. For reasons I don't know, because the story was 23 pages, just like the rest. I guess we got extra ads, because it's got this All-Star Squadron ad. But we're going to take another break, and then come back and talk about the second Crisis tie-in, Green Lantern number 195.
For Guy Gardner Podcast.
I got a fast connection, so I don't have to wait.
For Guy Gardner Podcasts.
There's always some new site.
For Guy Gardner Podcasts.
I browse all day and night.
For Guy Gardner Podcasts.
It's like I'm surfing at the speed of light.
For Guy Gardner Podcasts.
The internet is for
Guy Gardner Podcasts.
The internet is for
and sometimes Kyle Rayner Podcasts.
Why you think the net was born?
Guy Gardner Podcasts. Just One of the Guys is a weekly internet radio show dedicated to bringing you reviews, commentary, and a heartfelt defense of the characters of Guy Gardner and Kyle Rayner, the two Earth-based Green Lanterns who always seem to get dumped on. Over the next several years, I will be covering the Green Lantern books from cover date June 1990 until cover date November 2004. I'll also be covering the Guy Gardner solo series, as well as any other media that catches my fancy. The show can be found on iTunes by searching for Just One of the Guys Podcast, or by going to the website, justoneoftheguys.libsyn.com. So be sure to tune in every Friday for a fun-filled look at the Green Lantern Corps, hosted by me, Sean Ingle. It's just as enjoyable as the search for the subject that this song is actually about. JustOneOfTheGuys.libsyn.com. Yeah! Just One of the Guys does not officially certify that this podcast is more enjoyable than pornography.
And we have returned with the final issue of the episode, which is Green Lantern number 195, cover dated December 1985. It was released around September 19th of that year, 75 cents for 32 pages. And our cover, which is by Joe Staton and Bruce Patterson, shows the silhouetted form of a Green Lantern charging his ring and proclaiming, "At last, the power is mine, again!" And our story inside is simply titled Four, and it's never been reprinted. Credits are the same as the last two issues, which is Steve Englehart, author, Joe Staton, penciler, Bruce Patterson, inker, Anthony Tallon, colorist, Lois Buchholz, letterer, and Andy Helfer, editor. In the blink of an eye, the Guardian, Guy Gardner, and Hal Jordan are transported back to Oa. As they near the planet, Hal is cut loose and falls downward, blacking out just before he is caught in a cushioned plume of sand. The Guardian recaps how Guy was chosen as Hal's backup, but that when John Stewart was later selected after Guy was injured, and see episodes 6 and 1 for those stories. He further explains that, in books we haven't looked at, Guy recovered from his injuries and was asked by Hal to serve as Green Lantern while he tracked down a problem with his ring. Guy was thrilled, but the problem was actually in Hal's battery, which ended up exploding in Guy's face. After further interference from Sinestro and a trip to the Phantom Zone, Guy ended up a mindless vegetable. The Guardian explains that while they didn't authorize his first enrollment in the Corps, since John is busy fighting the Monitor's battle, they want to enroll him now. Back on Earth, Kat Matui works to stem the destruction caused by the crisis. She stops an earthquake and then begins to stop a volcano's eruption when her ring suddenly shorts out. She knows it must be the further effect of the barrier that appeared around Oa last issue, and worries that the entire Corps is doomed. Meanwhile, in the late 1800s, John's ring also shorts out in midst of a battle with the Shadow Demons, leaving him very confused. Back on Oa, Hal comes to and realizes he's landed in a part of Oa where the sand has been charged from a millennia of exposure to the central power battery, and apparently gained sentience because the sand itself tells him that. And just a piece of advice, remember, this is a comic book. If someone dumps you on a beach and the sand starts talking to you, you probably hit your head or took a lot of drugs. Anyway, Hal wills the sand to show him how to get to the Central Citadel. The sand reveals an underground research tunnel, and he follows it, only to run smack into a giant mud monster. Hal goes to town with the Hammers of Justice, but each blow just causes the creature to grow stronger and with more arms. He finally unleashes a barrage of blows, causing the creature to grow so many arms that he can't move, and Hal's able to escape. At the same time, Guy is confronted by six Guardians, who catch him up to speed on what's been happening over in Crisis, including the corruption of Corona, the birth of the Monitor and the Anti-Monitor, the onset of the Antimatter Universe, and that 15 of the Guardians have been imprisoned in a stasis beam which killed the central power battery. The six Guardians explain that they've channeled their own energies to create a second power battery, weaker than the first, but enough to power a small Corps of Lanterns. They offer the battery to Guy, saying they want him to become a Green Lantern in order to save the universe. Meanwhile, Hal reaches the main chamber and sees the captive Guardians and the dead central power battery. He's then confronted by the Green Lantern Honor Guards Charisma and Apros, who subdue Hal and bring him before 15 other Guardians. They fill Hal in on all the Crisis stuff, but being a little less proactive than the other six, say there's no hope. They've guarded the universe for millennia. Now it's reached its end, and they can do nothing but wait. Hal begs them to give him a ring so he can do something, but they say that he made his decision clear when he quit the Corps, and after a few choice words, teleport him away, presumably back to Earth. Back with the other six Guardians, they repeat their plan to form a new, smaller core to restore order. Whatever our guilt in the actions of an ancestor, we will guard this universe. Not until the end, but until there is no end. And with that, they hand Guy the newly formed battery and ring, and with a flash of emerald energy, Guy stands revealed as a Green Lantern, and swears that last time it was only for a day, but this time it will be forever.
All right, so I think that Jixit is up first.
Jixit!
I had very little notes. I did want to note that, you know, pages 19 through 23, when we see John, it actually took place in Crisis number 3, where they, as one of the five major battlegrounds, he was sent with to 1879 with Cyborg and Cymon, and basically teamed up with Jonah Hex, Scalp Hunter, Batlash to defend these tuning forks, with the plan to be that they would merge all these universes into one stronger universe, which would be able to fight off the effects of Anti-Monitor. But they kind of failed. Right after this little sputter, that little universe ceases to exist. And then right after this, Harbinger kills the Monitor because she was possessed by one of the Shadow Demons, and the heroes basically rejoin each other in issue number 4 under Alex Luthor of Earth 3, which, if I remember, that was the villain universe. So that's kind of where we're at with Crisis. I had more overall notes that, yeah, once again, we got the guy Gardner.
I just want to say really quick before you get into that, that Earth 3 and the Crisis on Infinite Earths and even before that, that was where all the heroes were villains. It's where you get all of the villains from the crime syndicate. Yeah, from the Crime Syndicate. They were part of the DVD release of Crisis on Two Earths, Justice League Crisis on Two Earths. And in that one, all the good guys are bad guys, and all the bad guys are good guys, and that's where we get Alexander Luthor.
He was sent away just as the planet was being destroyed by his parents, who would be our version of Lex Luthor, except here he's a good guy.
Exactly.
And this is the child who aged quickly.
And Alexander, as far as we are concerned, for a good long time, Alexander Luthor is a good guy.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And then, of course, yeah, once again, we have Guy's origin again. Not as much detail, but kind of brings us up to speed, obviously. I still have problems with them, with the Guardians, you know, choosing the Unbalanced. I don't know where this seemed like a good idea when really they could reach out to Hal. It's like, look, things are bad. Can you come back for just a little bit?
I'm with you on that, and I've got a similar note and discussion to go with it.
Well, really, on pages 8 and 9, we still have Cat Matui, even though her ring sputters out. And that just, even though the scene was kind of cool, it's generic superhero action. It felt like a little bit of filler. And of course, we mentioned kind of catching up with John. As I mentioned, I have next to no notes except for the talking sand was a little bit weird. I hope we get a much better explanation down the line.
Well, it's explained that it was already established in a previous Green Lantern book.
That there was kind of an already a spirit tube Oa?
Yes.
Okay.
That's in the issue, isn't it?
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, Green Lantern number 116.
Oh, now I'll have to go look at that. But yeah,
which I have not read, so there you go. I don't know beyond that.
What the heck is Apros? What kind of... He looks like a bundt cake.
I've got a note about that. I basically said... Wait, on this page, what, 15? It's a Rastafarian clayface.
But with this one, I was more along for the ride. Just trying to figure out what was happening and put all the pieces in once. Because a lot happened here. And we're building up to a bunch of different things that are coming down the pike. I dig Guy Gardner's costume. I like that it's different. I don't dig the belt, but I like the boots, the gloves, the vest look. It definitely gives him a distinct Green Lantern look.
Yeah.
I had a very similar note, but I'll get to that when I talk about it.
But that was really all I had. Mostly the Crisis stuff is what I was paying attention to this time around.
Jeffrey?
Okay. For me, Okay, pages 1 and 2. It's a good thing that Hal did not get lost in the circuits of time. In fact, before that, let me backtrack to the cover. I love this cover.
Mm-hmm.
This is an awesome cover. I don't own a copy of this, but I need to.
I would like a t-shirt with this on it.
Yes, and what we know that it's Guy Gardner. I mean, if we've been reading along, we know that it's Guy Gardner, but it also looks as though it could be Hal Jordan coming back to being a Green Lantern, which does not happen this issue. So, okay, yeah, Hal Jordan, you know, looks like it's a good thing that he didn't get lost in the circuits of time, but we get to page 3, and oh, he sort of did. Oh, well. And also on page 3, we see a grand scope of what Oa looks like, and it's yellow, which seems to me like a kind of a cruel joke. Page 4, okay, Guy's been in a coma for a heck of a long time. And I did not realize that it was quite that long, because we haven't really talked about the like an early Guy Gardner issue.
No, we talked briefly about his first appearance, but he just happened to pop up in another one, but that's it. That's all we had.
And that's it. And taking a look at page 7, they're talking about when Guy Gardner went into the Phantom Zone. And I have to wonder, is that the Phantom Zone Phantom Zone, or is it something else? But yeah, it appears to be the Superman Universe Phantom Zone.
Yes.
And that's pretty cool. So now I really want to go back and take a look at that. But anyway, on page 9, Cat Matui doesn't have time to have the ring teach her Spanish. Shouldn't it be able to just translate the Spanish? She goes to alien worlds all the time, and it just translates immediately. But Spanish is a tough one. Spanish is not that different from English, and Spanish is easier than English. But anyway, still on page 9, corking a volcano really shouldn't do much in the way of good. In fact, it should be bad. But again, it's
a special cork.
Right, but I mean, it's a nice visual, and I forgive it for that, for the same reason in the last issue where, you know, Mars and Jupiter were really close together. Well, moving on to...
Some of that you just have to accept with the comics. I mean, it's, you know...
Exactly. And I mean, some of it I can accept, some of it I don't accept. I have a hard time accepting. This one I do accept for the same reason as what I was trying to say before.
Right.
Page 10. Oh, that sucks. The Green Lantern ring just stops working. You're in the middle of trying to do something as a Green Lantern, and it just stops working. Imagine if you're out in space trying to, you know, get from one planet to another. Oh, that sucks. They just lost like half the core.
Yeah, I mean, that's... They don't talk about that, but that's a distinct possibility, because you never know what situation the Lanterns are going to be in when it just stops working.
We've seen it happen too.
Right. In that annual. Yeah.
Yep.
And we've seen it happen in some more recent times as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we'll get to that eventually. Around episode 138. But anyway, I'm guessing on that. It would be amazing if it turned out to be episode 138, but regardless. Page 11, finally we get this scene. Finally, Hal Jordan decides that he wants the ring back. He's talked about how, man, I wish I could get the ring back. It would maybe I should go and ask about getting the ring back. But here he's saying, I want the ring back. And that is a moment that we have been waiting for. It's a necessary moment. And when it's spread out across this amount of time where he is not Green Lantern, this is the moment that we've been waiting for. The next moment we're going to be waiting for is when he actually gets it back, but that's still a little bit down the road. Spoiler alert, sorry. And I'm curious to see how he goes about doing it, because I've never read that. But on the other hand, I seriously don't mind.
He kills John.
Okay. But on the other hand, I seriously don't mind if it takes a while. if we continue with this version of Hal Jordan, who is not a Green Lantern, doesn't have the ring, and he goes on a some sort of a quest to get the ring, I don't mind if it takes a while.
Yeah.
And this is just that moment of decision, and it's so important. Skipping ahead to page 13, where Hal is walking through the desert and he comes across this. It looks like a robotic sort of sinkhole. And my note is, no, Hal, don't do it. That's the Sarlacc. And he's just going to go through the hole because, I mean, what else are you going to do? You're in a desert and you come across that. What else are you going to do? You either go through that or you just keep wandering the desert. So it makes sense. And skipping ahead a few pages to page 18, I have two things. Number one, I don't get why the Guardians wouldn't pick an existing Green Lantern that they trusted, or even Hal Jordan, to be the one and only Green Lantern with a working ring. Instead, they chose Guy Gardner. And that just seems not only forced, but against expectations and against the characterization. Especially for the Guardians, who are smart.
Well, I mean, from what they say on the next couple pages here, that, you know, their position is that Guy, or that Hal made it pretty clear that he didn't want to be a Green Lantern anymore.
He had, and now he's saying that he does want to be a Green Lantern, especially in light of this crisis.
Right.
So he's flip-flopping.
He is.
They're taking him at his word, what he said first.
They are taking him at his word, but we're talking about an emergency for the Guardians. Right. They've all been knocked out, and I thought they were dead at one point, but they were just knocked out. And that means that there is a power that they cannot do anything against. Why not get an existing Green Lantern? They have 3,600 of them to choose from. Or possibly even bring back Hal Jordan as Green Lantern, since he says, yes, I want the ring. I will come back to being a Green Lantern Corps member. But instead, they go with Guy Gardner, and that just doesn't make sense to me.
Okay, yeah.
That's all. But the second thing that I wanted to say about this page 18, Guy promises to follow the Guardian's orders, but from what I know of him down the road, I'm pretty sure that's not a good idea now. Or ever. But regardless, skipping ahead to page 21, we're getting near the end of the issue for my notes. Really interesting explanation of the multiverse and how it's coming to an end, which we now in the present, or even like a year after this, know that that is very much the case, that the multiverse is coming to an end. But there's this great explanation on page 18 that I really like. I'm trying to find it real quick. And that description is actually very much in Crisis on Infinite Earths number 7. And it essentially explains that there is a multiverse, and that the multiverse is crumbling apart, and that it is forming one solid universe, which is what we were going to end up with by the time that the crisis is done. It's a very interesting explanation there. Page 22, you will never be a Green Lantern, they say to Hal Jordan. Oh my goodness. Because they are going to backtrack on that and they are going to look stupid. But be consoled that never is a very short time, because the universes are coming to an end, the multiverse is coming to an end, and that is just badass. You will never be a Green Lantern, but be consoled that never is not very long.
Since we're all going to die.
Exactly. And then the final page, 23. You know, I always liked Guy's jacket costume and the way that it's folded over like that. It is actually kind of like an 80s look. And I like it for that. They eventually go very 90s with him and give him that bowl cut haircut, which I kind of can't stand, but it still fits the character, so it's okay. But I like this costume, except for all the buckles just seem comic booky in 80s, which you know, I mean, I like a lot of things that are comic booky in 80s, and in this case it just seems weird and messed up and not necessary. because they're giving him a new costume that's different from all the Green Lantern costumes that have come before. And that style of jacket that he's wearing, even the collar, it's a lot bigger here than it will be far in the future. And I mean far in the future. Currently, he still has a very similar looking costume, but the collar has shrunk a bit because it's not the 1980s.
Right.
And the belt buckles are gone, and he looks a lot better in the current 2012 edition than he does here, just because those belt buckles really kind of bother me. He's got the huge chain around his belt where a belt would go, and he's got chains around the wrists of his gloves, like halfway up his arm, and he's got chains around the boots just below the kneecap.
Yeah, the modern-day costume is really the same. It's just more streamlined.
It's much more streamlined, and it doesn't have all the chains. Mm-hmm. But that's it for me. So how about you, Michael?
Pages 1, 2, 3, I love the art on these opening pages. It really feels like Joe Staton stepped up his game, or is at least settling in with the characters with these issues. And I mean, not that it was terrible before, but the art in these three issues has been really dynamic and action-packed, even when... during what could be rather boring scenes, like the one that Dave pointed out last issue, where that was basically a talking head scene as they were flying through space. Page 3, Guy says, "Where'd Jordan go? I owe him a kick in the face." Right from the start, Guy's bringing a whole different attitude to the book, and I am really looking forward to that. Pages 6 and 7, when I did my synopsis, I really kind of breezed through Guy's backstory because most of it wasn't all that important to this story. But if you're interested in, aside from the two issues we've covered, you can also check out Green Lantern issues 116 to 124, or stay tuned to an episode later this fall where we'll be covering an issue of Secret Origin that actually recaps a lot of Guy's origin. Page 8, another great page of art. I mean, just look how dynamic this page is. You've got Captain flying down from space and firing a ring. It's just a very... very exciting and dynamic page when there's not a lot exciting and dynamic happening. Page 10, like David said, this scene here is with John corresponds to Crisis number 3, but surprisingly it's a much larger scene there. Jumping ahead to page 15, it's understandable why he didn't, but I would have liked to have seen even more alien monsters stomping through the Citadel here, because if the science cells are down, then there should theoretically be creatures all over the place. But I looked it up, and this is actually the first appearance, or the first mention, of the science cells. So I thought that was kind of neat.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. I didn't either.
Page 16. I love seeing him actually take this creature on. You know, he didn't distract it, or just run off, or trip it up somehow. No, he actually goes in and takes the thing on in hand-to-hand combat. Which is stupid, yes, but also more the Hal Jordan man of action that I'm really enjoying.
And it's stupid in terms of the character, not stupid in terms of the story.
Right, right. Yeah. Page 23, not just Guy Gardner, but Green Lantern Guy Gardner. I'm very much looking forward to the next episode.
Yeah, of the next episode, I have physical copies of two of the three issues we're going to be talking about, because the covers really stood out to me, and they were in 50-cent bins.
And this segues, just to kind of set up your excitement for next episode, into the first two pages of Crisis on Infinite Earths number 9, in which we pick up from this very scene with Guy Gardner being bequeathed the ring, and out of nowhere an entropy opens, a huge antimatter flame comes down, destroys the chamber, kills all but one of the guardians we just saw, and sends Guy off to his next adventure. So if that doesn't wet your whistle, I don't know what will. It also
and
has
go ahead.
As an editor's note, continued in Green Lantern 195. So there's that.
It's interesting because scheduling-wise, I mean, this was very early in the comic book industry as a whole, especially DC and Marvel, trying to figure out how these kinds of crossovers would work, especially in the planning stages. And it very much does lead into Crisis on Infinite Earths number 9, which came out 1 week beforehand.
Mm-hmm. So even that's without email you know, there's no internet, there's no online scheduling. So this was all phone, mail, and they actually pulled it off. As much of a – and it was a little bit of a mess, but they pulled off something amazing with Crisis, so –
It is so much easier with email, I have to say. I do an online comic book right now called Slipstream, which is available at clockworkcomics.co.uk. And I'm working not only now with an artist, as I have been from the beginning, but now also a colorist. And I've realized that in order to hit the deadlines that we need to hit, I have an open Facebook message with both of them and our editor once a week at this point, just to let everybody know where we are, what's due, and what's going on. And they did not have that back then. Mm-hmm. So this was much harder, especially when you're dealing with this many people on this kind of a scope.
Well, the letters column returns this issue, but doesn't have much of note that I saw looking through it.
No.
There were a few Green Lantern appearances in other books released during the time period covered this episode, but aside from the Green Lantern stuff in issues 7 through 9 of Crisis, and Green Man's involvement in Omega Man 31 to 33, and then the second annual for that title, the only guest appearance of note was Blue Devil number 17, where John stops by for a cameo at the end of the story to draw Blue Devil into aiding with the Crisis. And that's actually a scene that's repeated in Crisis on Infinite Earths number 8. But we did have issues 8 through 10 of Who's Who in the DC Universe, which included profiles of Goldface, the Gordanians, Green Lantern Alan Scott, Green Lantern Hal Jordan, Green Lantern John Stewart, the Green Lantern Corps as a unit, the Green Man, which you can read to get caught up on him since he's technically not a Green Lantern at the moment, the Guardians of the Universe, Harbinger, and Hector Hammond. And like always, I will be posting those on the website at greenlanternslight.com in the Who's Who section, so you can get caught up on all the exciting characters that are in the book. But that's it for this episode.
And I just want to point out one last thing. This is something that you can find if you go to movies.com. And you can find me on there, Jeffrey Taylor. Maybe find an article that I've already written. And you can click on my name and you'll see a list of articles that I've written. One of the most recent ones is about the 1 million moms versus the comic book industry, which in our terms for this show has to do with Alan Scott, who we've not had to deal with almost at all through the course of this show. But he has come out as being gay, the character that is. He's from an alternate universe. And the 1 million moms, they're a Christian hate group that has decided to go against the comic book industry for really, really weird reasons. But I have a whole article about it, and you can find it there on that. It's probably, by the time this comes out, a couple of months old, if you're interested in doing that. But since he is a Green Lantern and this is Green Lantern's Light, I thought I should at least mention it so that if anybody wants to track down that article, I feel like I put a lot into it, and it's going to be up on Monday as the time that we record this, but it could be a good 2 months ahead of time. So anybody who wants to backtrack and just take a look at that, by all means, feel free.
We will be talking about Alan Scott at some point. Mm-hmm. I know there's a story or two when we get to Green Lantern Corps Quarterly. There's an Alan Scott or two story in there. But other than that, yeah, not too much probably for a while.
Yeah, and Alan Scott is also in Crisis on Infinite Earths. But mm-hmm. Again, it's a different version.
Right.
Because the version that the 1 million moms are complaining about is the version that is from Earth 2 of the New 52 multiverse.
Well, next episode, we'll be looking at Green Lantern issues 196, 197, and 198. Plus, I'm sure there will be more Crisis talk because issue 198 is bannered as a Crisis tie-in.
Mm-hmm.
But until then, my name is Michael Bradley.
I'm J. David Weider.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to another episode of Green Lantern's Light, hosted by Michael Bradley,
Jeffrey Taylor,
and J. David Weider. Show notes, past episodes, and other information about the show can be found at greenlanternslight.com. You can also subscribe to the show directly via the RSS feed and on iTunes.
If you'd like to get in touch with the show, drop us a line to greenlanternpodcast@gmail.com or use the contact form at the website. You can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter to get updates and interact with us directly. Let us know your thoughts, and we might even read your message on a future episode.
Green Lantern and all related elements are copyright DC Comics. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you'll come back next month. But until then,
in brightest day,
in blackest night,
no evil shall escape our sight.
Let those who worship evil's might
beware our power.
Green Lantern's light.